this report contains so much complex information that I don't see how the legislature could respond to it alone.
A new report on the status of women in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, mapping the potential for big earthquakes in Alaska.
We still do not know the potential of these zones for generating larger earthquakes, so there's always a potential there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
A report released today offers stark findings on the status of Alaskan women. Women in the state earn much less than their male counterparts, have been imprisoned at a higher rate during the last decade, and are committing suicide at a rate twice as high as the rest of the United States. Senator Liesl McGuire asked the nonpartisan Legislative Research Services to prepare the report last year. She says the biggest surprise for her in the data was how little women earn compared to men in Alaska.
One of the good points in the data was that women are more educated than they've ever been in Alaska at any other point in history. That's good. But the devastating part is that women are still making 67 cents on the dollar in the combined categories of both full and part-time work. The other part that was very disturbing for me was the suicide rates. The fact that women are committing suicide rates at 2.1 times the national average as a whole, and in particular those young women that are committing suicide before they even reach the age of majority, before they even get out of high school. Finally, I think the third really disturbing area for me is in the area of homelessness, and this was one of the points that I was making in the Finance Committee last year that led to me commissioning this report. We were talking about the area of affordable housing. And this is something my office has spent a lot of time working on and will continue to work on with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. There is a shortage of affordable housing for all Alaskans. And I want to emphasize that I am concerned about that for all Alaskans. But in particular, there was a discussion about women and children having access to affordable housing. And sure enough, this report comes back to show that 62% of all the adults and children in our homeless shelters are women and children.
The report notes the percentage of female inmates jumped from 6.5% in 2007 to 11% in 2011. Does the report at all offer hints or suggestions as to what is behind that increase?
Not that I can see in the crosstabs, but that is something that I intend to look at. There is a discussion about the rates of drug addiction and alcohol addiction going up during that same time period. If I had to take a guess, I would say that it's likely that the area of incarceration tracks along those particular offenses. And the other thing I want to say is that as an action item related to this, I'm going to drop legislation to reinstitute the Women's Commission because, frankly, I think that this report contains so much complex information that with a 90-day session, I don't see how the legislature could respond to it alone. The Alaska Women's Commission and its predecessor, the Alaska Commission on the Status of Women, existed as a legislatively created commission from 1978 to June 30th, 1988. It was actively involved in conducting professional research and identifying problems and solutions to many family and equity-based problems for Alaskan women. And I think we need to reinstitute that commission to help Alaskan women across all ages and all races.
Is that something you anticipate you'll do yet this session?
Yes. I anticipate dropping the legislation. Now, we're very close. I just got the report back, and we're very close to the end of the first year of this session. So the odds of it passing this year are very unlikely, but I intend to introduce it this session so that it can be out there for conversation along with the report for people to talk about and digest and for its passage next year.
Senator Liesl McGuire requested the newly released legislative report on the status of women in Alaska. To read the report, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. State House and Senate Democrats called a hearing titled Save Our Schools on Monday at the Capitol to bolster their fight for increased public school funding. Minority members say they've been getting hundreds of emails and other comments from frustrated parents, teachers, school administrators, and education boards asking for the same. They want money for pre-kindergarten programs, inflation-proofing for the base student allocation, and no constitutional amendment to allow public dollars to flow to religious and private schools. Anchorage parent Matt Johnson spoke at the end, summing up 2 hours of testimony.
We really need to fully fund our public schools and our pre-K early learning programs. I don't think money is always the bottom line, but I think it's a proven fact that early education saves everybody money, saves our state money, saves our society money. I strongly oppose any voucher system for our public schools and strongly oppose any tinkering with our Alaska Constitution. And finally, I would say that I believe we are one of the wealthiest states in the union, if not the wealthiest. What kind of a people can't fund their public education system but can hand over billions to the oil companies?
Johnson was alluding to the bill moving through the legislature that would reduce taxes on Alaska's oil producers. The latest fiscal note indicates the state would lose between $4.5 and $5.8 billion in revenue through 2019. Only two speakers at yesterday's hearing took the opposite stance, including John Thomas of the Mat-Su region. He agrees with many in the Republican-led legislature who say public schools aren't wisely using the money they get.
Is throw money at it. Throw money at it. The children. Education is untouchable. This is our primary responsibility. We've tried it that way for decades, people. Now it's time to tighten our belts and get with the program.
Democrats are a small caucus in the legislature, and their Republican colleagues were not at yesterday's hearing. And Democrats' legislation to inflation-proof the base student allocation is not moving. The BSA is the formula used to calculate the per-student cost of education. It's remained at $5,680 since 2011. Republican chairs of the House and Senate Education Committees say proposed increases in education funding are not likely to gain traction in these last 3 weeks of the session. A reward is being offered for information in the death of two golden eagles whose bodies were recently found near a hiking trail in south central Alaska. According to Bruce Woods with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the eagles, a female and an immature male, were discovered on top of a pile of bait meat and surrounded by snares.
The eagles were not in the snares at the time they were found. They were dead. They had not been shot, and they were on top of the bait pile.
Woods says the bodies were not decomposed and that the birds had not been shot, although authorities are not releasing more information about the condition of the bodies at this time. Woods says he does not know if there will be a necropsy on the birds.
There was sufficient evidence on site to indicate what caused the mortality. I do know that our agents are not releasing any more information on the cause of mortality, as that might be pertinent to the investigation.
The site of the eagle deaths is Anthracite Ridge near Chicoloon. Fish and Wildlife is offering $2,500 for information leading to a conviction in the case. Eagles are protected under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. Violations of the act could result in a $100,000 fine and/or a year in federal prison. Wood says more than one violation of the Bald and Golden Eagle Act adds up to a serious crime.
Two violations under that act would raise the status of the crime to a felony.
Wood says American Indians and Alaska Natives are allowed to use eagle parts and feathers in spiritual ceremonies, although the feathers and parts are kept by the National Eagle Repository near Denver, and there is an application for their use. Wood says it is likely the eagle bodies will be sent to the repository. There's been a major shakeup at the top of Koniag Incorporated, the regional native corporation for the Kodiak Islands area. In a release today, it was announced that Will Anderson has agreed to step down as the president and chief executive officer, positions he has held for the past 7 years. No reason was given for the departure. Tom Panameroff will serve as interim president, while board chair Ron Unger will serve as interim CEO. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, walking 800 miles of coastline at toddler speed.
That makes it much more uncertain because we're guessing what our four-year-old's pace is going to be.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A write-in candidate is challenging Anchorage Assembly Chair Ernie Hall for a seat representing West Anchorage in the upcoming municipal election. His name is Nick Mull. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Hey, Susie. How's it going? I've been talking you up to a lot of folks, and I was talking about your accomplishment yesterday of calling 190 folks. Nick Mull here.
That's Nick Moe, phoning some of the approximately 100 or so volunteers that he says have teamed up to try to get him elected to the Anchorage Assembly through a write-in campaign. Moe, who declared he was running on March 19th, says since then his campaign has taken on a life of its own.
Since last week, we've grown into a pretty incredible organization. You know, we have over 500 likes on Facebook. We're reaching out to 38,000 people on Facebook now. There are hundreds of people who are getting involved in the campaign, volunteering to connect with voters, to put up yard signs, to make phone calls, and to get the word out that the campaign exists and West Anchorage has a choice.
Assembly Chair Ernie Hall was running unopposed until Moe jumped into the race as a write-in last week. Moe says he's challenging Hall, the current representative in seat D, because he hasn't been listening to his constituents, especially when it comes to AO 37, an ordinance proposed by Mayor Dan Sullivan that would limit unions, and which is supported by Hall.
You know, there's over 1,000 people that showed up to these assembly meetings to speak out, that just wanted to share their input and work with the assembly to improve the document. And not only did Ernie Hall not listen, but he shut off testimony.
Moe says he decided to run when he heard that Hall shut down the public hearing before everyone had a chance to speak. Moe is no stranger to politics. At 19, he ran against Mark Begich for mayor of Anchorage. After the election, Begich hired him as a renewable resources intern to work on energy and recycling issues. Since then, the 26-year-old has worked as a legislative aide and as a government relations director for University of Alaska Anchorage. Assembly Chair Hall has lived in West Anchorage since 1961. He served on the Assembly in Seat D for 3 years. He says in that time he's done a lot for West Anchorage. Hall owned Alaska Furniture Manufacturers for 45 years and is now retired. Hall says he refutes Moe's accusation that he hasn't been listening to people in West Anchorage. Hall admits, though, that he does support the union ordinance.
That document was drafted by the administration. I was on it as a co-sponsor, and the reality is anything that comes from administration to the assembly has to come through the chair. So that was one of the reasons that my name was on it. But I am a supporter of it.
The proposed ordinance was announced on February 8th by Mayor Dan Sullivan. It would limit unions and give the mayor and assembly increased power over union negotiations. It would impact about 2,200 municipal employees. Hall ended the testimony after listening to 4 5-hour evenings where 285 people spoke before the assembly. To Moe's challenge, Hall says voters should look at his accomplishments since he's been serving on the assembly.
If you look at the accomplishments that I've had from the Campbell Creek Estuary, Spinard Road, the West Anchorage District Plan, Title 21, I think that I've been a very big part of accomplishing each one of those, and that's for pretty major task that had been accomplished during my time on the assemblies.
But Hall says if West Anchorage voters aren't satisfied with him, they now have another choice. Municipal elections are Tuesday, April 2nd. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A new interactive map lays out the earthquake potential across Alaska. The online map uses a color-coded system to identify locations that have experienced earthquakes. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Areas that have had major earthquakes over the last 150 years, like the Aleutians, Gulf of Alaska, and the Alaska Range, have red lines along them, tracing underlying active faults. But not every highlighted area has a history of major damaging shakers. State earthquake geologist Rich Kaler says the Fairbanks area is circled in red because of local faults that produce numerous small earthquakes.
That's not to say we couldn't have a larger one. In 1937, the Salchas seismic zone just to the east of us had a magnitude 7. So we still do not know the potential of these zones for generating larger earthquakes. So there's always a potential there.
Kaler says it's a common misconception that areas like Fairbanks with frequent smaller quakes are safe from larger damaging events. He says the new map is based on earthquakes measured by seismometers as well as observation of surface deformations that correspond with active faults. He says both tools were useful in mapping the Denali Fault, where a 7.9 magnitude quake, the biggest ever recorded in interior Alaska, occurred in 2002.
The Denali Fault, if you look on a seismicity map, the 2002 rupture patch shows up with just intense seismicity, and those are aftershocks after the event. But if you look towards Denali Park, to the west along the Denali Fault, there's far less seismicity. Yet the expression in the geomorphology and on the surface is virtually identical.
Kaler says compiling all the earthquake information into one map provides an easily accessible resource for research and planning. He says the online map allows you to zoom in on individual properties to get a very localized picture of earthquake risk, a useful tool for researchers, planners, and others.
Engineers on big infrastructure projects, just the general public, people who are buying a house sometimes want to know, you know, if there's a seismic zone next to it or on the property. People doing gold mining exploration, they want to know where the faults are.
Kaler says using the online earthquake map is much easier than wading through data from various sources. He says Alaska's new web portal is up to speed with those provided by government in the similarly seismically active states of California, Nevada, and Washington. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A school group from earthquake and tsunami-ravaged cities in Japan visited Fairbanks over the weekend. The Japanese government-sponsored cultural exchange included 26 high school students and their teachers.
My name is Kaoru Ishikawa. I'm from Tangajo High School in Miyagi Prefecture. We come to here to tell the truth situation in Japan now and appreciate the United States to help us after the disaster.
Ishikawa says the exchange project is called Kizuna, which means the relationship between people. The program paid for 23 Lathrop High School students and hundreds of others from across the country to visit Japan last summer. Now students from Japan are on a two-week tour of the U.S., staying with host families and doing presentations on impacts and recovery from the March 2011 earthquake and tsunami that killed nearly 16,000 people. The students talked about losing friends and relatives in the disaster and how people pulled together to take care of each other. Lathrop High Curriculum Director and Japan Exchange Program Chaperone Peggy Carlson says the experience has been eye-opening.
Really see what had happened after the earthquake. And something that really struck me was the folks that talked to us were very much concerned about what we should do in the future, what we should learn from this, as opposed to look what happened to us.
The Japanese student group spent Sunday at Chena Hot Springs and is now in Seattle for a West Coast tour that will complete their two-week trip to the U.S.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A Seldovia family that has made a habit of taking on long journeys around some of the wildest parts of Alaska is at it again. Later this month, they'll be taking off from their yurt on the south side of Kachemak Bay for an 800-mile walk along the entire coast of Cook Inlet. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
One of the things you have to remember is that what makes news is people who either screwed up or got unlucky. There's people who go out into the wilderness, make smart choices, they do it every day, and you never hear about them in major motion pictures.
That's Aaron McKittrick in the trailer for Journey on the Wild Coast, a documentary film made about her first big adventure, a year-long walk along the coast from Seattle to the Aleutian Islands with her husband, Brettwood Higman. That journey was completed in 2007 before the couple had two children and settled on the south side of Kachemak Bay near Higman's hometown of Seldovia. But if you're thinking having children might slow down McKittrick and Higman, you'd be wrong. They took their oldest child, Katmai, on an expedition around northwest Alaska's Chukchi Sea in 2010 when he was still a baby. And the next year, the family set off for Malaspina Glacier for a two-month trek with Katmai and their one-year-old daughter, Latuya. This week, McKittrick and Higman are preparing for their latest adventure, an 800-mile coastal walk along the entirety of Cook Inlet.
So we're going to start out at the tip of the Kenai Peninsula, and we're going to work our way up around Kachemak Bay through Homer, up towards Turnagain Arm, through Anchorage, across Kinnick Arm, and then all the way down the west side of Cook Inlet to Cape Douglas.
The family will mostly be walking that 800 miles, says Higman, and they'll be moving at what McKittrick refers to as Katmai pace.
He's our four-year-old son, and he's very excited that he's going to walk all the way around Cook Inlet by himself.
Little Latuya will be riding along with mom and dad, but Katmai is going to walk all 800 miles. So how does that affect planning for a trip like this?
That makes it much more uncertain because we're guessing what our four-year-old's pace is going to be. And, of course, we took that into consideration for our entire schedule. But, you know, we've never done something where he walks, you know, day after day after day, like, to know how exactly that's going to average out. So we think we know what the pacing is going to be, but, you know, within the first month, we'll know a lot more.
McKittrick and Higman are planning on 4 months for the entire trek. Higman says they are tentatively titling the trip Tracing the Heart of Alaska. He says they chose Cook Inlet because of its unique diversity.
Both in terms of the wild landscapes and also in terms of the people. I mean, if you think about little towns like Seldovia where we live and, of course, Anchorage, and there's native villages, Tyonek and Nanwalek, the Russian villages, industrial facilities at Nikiski. There's a lot of variation in people along this coast, and I think it's a really good expression of some of the diversity that's across much of Alaska.
The couple hopes to meet with as many local people as they can along the way, and maybe even be joined by some for parts of the trip. For those of us who won't be able to join them, McKittrick says she plans on writing about the journey and taking many photos, even though she may not always be able to get them up on the couple's website.
So I have, you know, actual paper and an actual pencil, and I take notes and often write blog posts and books later, and we love to take photographs.
In many places, especially on the eastern side of Cook Inlet, the family will be connected to civilization, including an internet connection. But once they leave Anchorage later this summer and cross Kinnick Arm for the western side of the inlet, they will be surrounded by wilderness. They've planned food drops in a handful of places to resupply along the way and will be carrying two small pack rafts to cross rivers and other wetlands. Higman says that depending on weather, the couple plans to leave sometime in the next week or so. You can learn more about the family's plans and see some remarkable photos, video, and writings from their past adventures at their website, groundtruthtrekking.org. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
The newest piece of art for the new Ketchikan Public Library building is an installation called A Trip to the Library. Artists Yvonne Zerberts and Rich Stage were at the library after hours last weekend working out the logistics of hanging the complex piece. KRBD's Layla Carey joined them and has this story.
Art isn't usually that noisy. Neither are libraries, for that matter, but once it's in place, the newly installed artwork will be quiet, albeit full of movement, both real and implied. The name of the piece, A Trip to the Library, is a play on words. It portrays a young man who's stumbled on his way out.
He has found so many books in this library that he wants to read that he has amassed this huge stack of books. And as he leaves, they are just flying through the air.
Zerbits and Stage knew they wanted a young man for the main sculpture. Zerbits says she loves the Guys Read campaign that encourages reading among boys. The sculpture was modeled after a real person who agreed to endure, well, here's Zerbits again to explain the process.
We used Andy Pankow for the head cast. He was he was incredible. He had rubber, I don't know how many pounds, like about 5 or 6 pounds of rubber and plaster on his head for 2 to 3 hours. And he was pretty amazing. I don't think very many people could do that.
Stage then sculpted the resin head cast so it doesn't really look like the model anymore. Stage, who was reluctant but not completely opposed to talking on the record, also created the metal frame skeleton for the piece, which isn't as heavy as it looks.
It's under a ton. It's all wire frame. It should probably weigh maybe 70 pounds.
We can lift him, but he's just awkward.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
His balance points are really crazy.
Yeah. So he's all hollow inside.
Other art pieces already installed at the library include metal sculptures by the salvage divas Rhonda Green and Anne Fitzgerald, depicting Alaska's wildlife, and a colorful, whimsical fabric tree in the children's section. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.